Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
And Bob Hill.
And today on the show, we've got Miss Sally Benson, who is the editor of American Nurseryman, and Mr. Matt Zinder, who is the proprietor of Willowbank Garden Company, actually based, you know, from Finchville, but they do a lot of large installations, the Shelbyville, Lexington, Louisville area.
And China.
And, exactly. But we, you know, which is fabulous in and of itself. But Matt's coming in to talk about some stuff that he's been working on over the past year in China. He's working for design firms there, doing big hotels and developments and that sort of thing, and just kind of interesting tales in terms of working somewhere else altogether.
Well, they're massive developments, mm-hmm. as China is wont to do, and very interesting guy, very interesting guest. Be sure and listen to this thing, because he gives details of projects they're doing in China with primarily Chinese plants and an American flavor to them. Mm-hmm. Fascinating stuff.
Yeah, I think there's more to the story than just kind of what it is. It's just that multicultural, global sort of experience, too. So Sally Benson's also on the show today?
Yeah, one of the joys of owning a nursery is I can read American Nurseryman guilt-free, because, hey, I understand it as a product, but it's really a very good trade publication, because they're pretty honest about things and upfront about things in the business. And Sally Benson's the editorial director, and every year they have the best plants for the upcoming year. And this year they've got 180-some, all photographed and listed in the magazine. And they are on the website, so go to the Homegrown website at the end of the show, and you'll be able to see these plants yourself.
Mm-hmm.
What's up with the Wishy Estate?
Doing a little dreaming, that's for sure.
Yeah, right.
But remember that pine tree that knocked me back into the road?
Yeah.
When we were cutting it down? Well, guess what Andy did? He made homemade fatwood. Have you ever used fatwood to start a fire?
This isn't the same as the fat stuff we were talking about.
No, that was fat pork.
I'm wondering about it.
But have you ever heard of fatwood before?
Yes, but I've never done it yet.
Okay, well, because we've bought it from, you know, catalogs before. You know, they're like little pieces of kindling, basically.
Right.
And it's the heartwood of pines.
Yep.
And it's the heartwood, so it's not the sappy, sticky stuff that you would get from the outer layers of the bark of a pine tree, but that fat wood, small pieces, you use it as kindling and you really get your fire going, you know, efficiently, mm-hmm. and well. So Andy took this pine tree that we cut down and took the little like hand axe and started cutting little pieces of the heartwood out and brought me up this big basket full of homemade fat wood.
And it worked.
It was fabulous. Yeah, totally works. And I usually don't use it unless I have like a shortage of good kindling, that sort of thing, because I'm not just going to waste it. But I was so impressed by his ability to even know that that's where your fat wood came from was amazing to me.
Did you count his fingers before and after?
I did not, because he's so safety conscious.
You go, Andy.
I actually got him safety equipment. I got him one of those steel helmets,
yep.
with the earphones and the flip top.
Yeah.
After reading Brush Cat, I'm like, my baby needs some head protection. So that's what he got for Christmas. Very safety conscious.
Oh, yeah.
How about your garden, Bob?
I'm sort of in a dream phase myself. I either have dumb ideas or really dumb ideas, and I never know until I execute them which one is which. But I've got these two church pews that came from Gethsemane,
mm-hmm.
via Louisville Architectural Salvage. And I've been wondering what to do with them for a long time, and I was looking out the front window of the yard this morning, in fact. And I think I'm going to build a little gazebo out front and put the two church pews out in the middle of a shaded area,
mm-hmm.
under a gazebo.
That sounds beautiful.
Wouldn't that be cool?
I think it sounds beautiful.
Yeah, and then you'll sit out there and, who knows, Thomas Merton.
You don't really have a gazebo anywhere, do you?
I have one for the Bluegrass Festival, but mm-hmm. not one like this. This is going to be out mm-hmm.
That's a stage almost.
The front yard.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But this is going to be my Thomas Merton Memorial gazebo.
That
he may have
nice.
Sat on these pews.
Yeah.
Who knows?
He very well could have.
I'm going to, until proven otherwise, until he shows up and says, I did not sit on
those pews. That sounds great.
I'm going to do that.
It sounds like a very good project.
Okay.
And there's, I bet you, some really good new plant ideas for the shade for around this fabulous gazebo in January's edition of American Nurseryman. Sally Benson's joining us now. She's got a couple of them to highlight, but there are many more still.
Yeah, she's the editorial director of the American Nurseryman, a magazine that's been covering commercial horticulture since 1904. But in recent years, the magazine has been highlighting the best plants for the upcoming year, and Sally's with us today to tell us all about them. Sally, welcome to Homegrown.
Thank you so much. It's my pleasure.
Yeah, first, let's talk some about American Nurseryman, the magazine itself. It's been around since 1904.
That's right, 105 years.
Do you know the history of it, and can tell us, kind of catch us up to how it's evolved from what it was to what it is?
I sure do. It started actually well before 1904, in the late 1800s, as a couple different magazines. It was National Nurseryman and, I believe it was a florist magazine, mm-hmm. merged to basically cover the broad spectrum of the green industry in the U.S. And by that I mean we go to the professionals in the horticulture industry, including growers of ornamental plants. We don't necessarily deal with people who grow plants for food, mm-hmm. Commodity plants. Growers of ornamentals, woodies, and perennials. Mm-hmm. The landscape team, which is so vast, it encompasses landscape designers and architects, landscape contractors, just a vast, vast crew. And then rounding that out are the retailers, the people who own and operate garden center shops. Quite often there's overlap among the three groups.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So in order to serve this entire industry, we decided it was best to go to everyone.
Mm-hmm. Well, and if you just look at the last 20 years,
mm-hmm.
hasn't your job become even more important because the industry itself has grown significantly?
It has. It's grown, and it's also gained quite a bit of recognition.
Mm-hmm.
We flew under the radar for years and years and years. People simply didn't understand that there was an actual industry behind the plants that they bought.
Right.
Right.
Exactly.
And it's kind of a natural thing. We all grow up with plants. We all are familiar with them. Whether we really think about them or not, they're around us, and grandma gardened and mom gardened and the neighbors gardened, but many of us never really gave a thought to the fact mm-hmm. that there are people whose livelihoods depend on actually producing the plants that we go out and buy and plant.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I always look forward to the issue this time of year, the new plants for now 2010, and there must be hundreds to choose from. How do you pick the plants?
Well, it is not an easy job.
No.
This year we received submissions from, I can't remember the number of companies, but the total submissions was nearly 200 plants.
Mm-hmm.
And that runs the gamut from annuals through large trees.
So was there a criteria in terms of what could be submitted? Did they have to be brand new for this year?
Definitely.
Okay.
And what we mean by new, and that's mm-hmm. kind of a difficult thing for some people to understand,
mm-hmm.
what we mean by new is that it's new to the industry. It's
okay.
not been seen in commerce in the country.
Okay.
So if a grower or even a retailer has taken on a new plant for their particular inventory this year, but it's already been sold by someone else,
mm-hmm.
that doesn't necessarily qualify.
And it's new, right.
It needs to be new to the industry
okay.
and new to the market, basically.
Not just new to me.
For the coming year.
But speaking of consumers, you also have a website. Are they allowed to sneak on and take a look at the newer plants and then kind of encourage their local nurserymen to go get them?
You bet.
Okay.
You bet.
Yeah.
And there can be some confusion there, especially new plant introductions are so enticing,
right?
Especially to the gardening public. And we've had wonderful relationship with garden writers, but there is kind of a disconnect every once in a while when garden writers, and bless their hearts, they have been wonderful at getting the word out about all these exciting new plants, but sometimes we find that they jump the gun,
mm-hmm. uh-huh.
Or the growers go directly to the garden writers and get the word out to the public, and the public is thrilled, can't wait to get their hands on a new plant.
And they can't.
But that doesn't necessarily mean that the numbers are there,
mm-hmm.
that the inventory has been built
mm-hmm.
to sufficient volume. So there's always a little challenge here and there.
We may have to be patient with some of them.
The enthusiasm is just amazing.
Yeah. So, Sally, you said you had over 200 submissions. How many
right.
did you ultimately choose for the
We chose 82 for the magazine in print.
Okay.
And then we chose 180 for the magazine online.
So most of them online, okay.
That's right.
You said you didn't bother, you don't pick too many from the annual category because you're a little bit more interested in perennials and woodies and
our
stuff.
Our readers primarily concentrate on perennials and trees and shrubs, woody plants.
So what were some of your favorites?
Oh, gosh. that's like asking an editor to pick out her favorite word.
I'm sorry.
It's so tempting. I am always drawn to grasses.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
They are so multipurpose. They get kind of a bad rap every now and then. I have very, very good friends who are excellent gardens who will argue up and down that they're nothing but weeds.
Right.
You know, I see them in the prairie. I don't care to cultivate them. I don't want them in my garden. But they can act as focal points. They can fill in an entire garden. The movement is just fantastic with a lot of these grasses.
Oh, yeah.
One of my particular favorites is Casmanthium latifolium. It's northern sea oats.
Mm-hmm.
Nice, clean strap leaves. A new one this year is called River Mist, and it's variegated.
Oh, boy.
So there is just, within the movement, you also get a little flash of white. You have a green strap, you get a flash of white. So it adds to the movement, it glimmers. And then you get these just gorgeous seed heads. And we used to call them spangle plants because they look like little hanging spangles.
That's a great name for them.
It is, and they rustle, and they make this wonderful little kind of clicking sound. It's just the most wonderful plant to have.
How about some perennials to go in combination with that?
I would actually go a little bit different texture.
Okay.
Try to combine the textures, not so that it's a cacophony, you know, not so that it's completely disjointed garden, but some of the lower growing perennials, there are some beautiful new geraniums out. There's a very, very deep pink and there's a kind of a light pink, but I would also go with some of the more delicate plants. There's a gem called Mai Tai. It's the most beautiful, kind of a sweet yellow with a little bit of a pink margin.
Sounds nice.
Very, very delicate flower, but the plant itself is very hardy. It's sturdy. It's a real trooper.
Mm-hmm.
If you want something very large, if you want to go the other way and you want a real statement and kind of a monster in the garden, there are a couple new eupatoriums that are just enormous. One is called Big Nate and one is called Glenda. One, I believe it's Big Nate, reaches nearly 10 feet tall.
Wow. That sounds
serve
great.
A couple purposes there. You can
a
have a hedge that, you know, will die back and clean itself up nicely. It can act basically as a shrub. Nevertheless, it's still a perennial.
Mm-hmm. All right. I've always been really fond of salvias.
Sally. Yep, I was going to mention
and there's some. There's two that look fabulous. Sparkle and then Ultraviolet.
Right. New ones from Monrovia, and there's a new series out from Monrovia, and the colors are just exquisite. It's kind of difficult to explain it, and it's a little bit difficult to even photograph it, but there's an iridescence to the bloom. It's very, very subtle, but when planted en masse, there's kind of a glow. And they range from a real hot, hot pink to more delicate kind of deep pink to a delicate light pink all the way to a white. And if you kind of scatter that white throughout, it really pops the other colors. It is just astonishing what that plant can do. Now that's one plant that I call kind of a workhorse.
Sure, me too. I think that's why I like
it's so virtually indestructible. If you've got a very, very dry site, it's just a given. It's very reliable, and the foliage is nice and clean. It's nothing spectacular. It's just something that you can put in and rely on it and know that it's going to come back year after year and keep giving.
Yeah, I fell in love with I love Alstroemeria, and they do okay here and well-drained, but the new one I saw in your magazine was Tangerine Tango.
That's right.
Just an incredible.
I was kind of surprised that they're marketing it now as a perennial. We've always known it as an annual.
Yeah.
But they've been working diligently on hardiness, and that's a color that can't be beat.
It was amazing.
You know, you see, that's the flower that you see quite often in the middle of a restaurant table.
Right.
But in your garden, it lends a little bit of a kind of a tropical note. But again, en masse, it's just, it's a lily-like flower, kind of small, not, you know, a real dramatic lily, but it's a beautiful, beautiful bloom.
You know, Bob and I joke about how, you know, from time to time, a plant can seemingly be the perfect plant and everybody wants it, but, you know,
right,
on down the road, it turns out to be a bit of a dog.
Indeed. Yes, indeed.
Is there any way, I guess there's really no way for us to know that any one plant that's listed in the magazine could potentially not quite pan out the way that everybody
hopes.
Right,
and that's something that is so difficult to predict, and it's so difficult for the growers, too.
Yeah.
What we try to get across to the growers is that we need to be able to assure our readers that these are reliable plants. The testing is critical. We know their enthusiasm for developing new plants and for getting them to market. There, I'd say in the past 5 or 6 years, there's been kind of a rush to get new plants.
Right, too much, yeah.
And that's right. And it's part of it is driven by the enthusiasm, simply the passion for these new plants, and part of it is driven by a public that is so hungry for something new and so excited to see the next big thing. And you certainly, you can't blame either side.
Right.
No.
But there have been some problems. Lime Rock Ruby, a few years ago, the Coreopsis was a perfect example. Beautiful color. And sold nationwide as a very hardy plant.
Yep.
And it kind of gave people a black eye.
Yeah.
It didn't come back, and understandably, gardeners were very upset going back to the garden centers, and the garden centers had to go back to the growers.
But they're still trying because there's a fabulous Coreopsis similar to Lime Rock Ruby called Creme Caramel, kind of related to Creme Brulee, which actually is one of my all-time favorite Coreopsis. So I'm, I'll be getting that for sure and hoping that it does better.
That appears to have kind of a range. It can be kind of a salmon through a really deep orange and then to a red.
Cool.
So we're hoping that that's something that really pans out because that everyone knows Moonbeam. Everyone knows,
Zagreb.
You know, we've got wonderful, bright yellow, very happy-looking Coreopsis. But they're hungry for different colors, for a richer, deeper color.
Yeah. Well, my prediction for the next big thing, hit or miss, is the Hydrangea arborescens Invincible, the pink Annabelle. It's going to be incredible. It's going to be in everybody's yard within 5 years.
I think so.
Just like Annabelle.
Because everybody likes Annabelle.
That's right.
But then have Annabelle be pink and come back every year on new growth is almost too much.
And this gives such a beautiful blush.
Yeah.
That I think it's going to stand out quite a bit.
I've got two already.
Do you?
Yeah.
There have been some real home runs in a lot of the introductions.
That's going to be it.
And I think you're right. I think that's going to be something that is going to be one of those must-have plants.
So, Sally, anything that stands out that's very unusual?
There's an Ophiopogon called Black, I think it's Black Beard. It's a Mondo grass. It's a black Mondo grass that is striking. And I know that, you know, many, many people kind of shudder when you mention a plant of any kind that has any black in it. It's not morbid. It's not morose. It is such a gorgeous accent. Taken by itself in a pot, it's a beautiful, beautiful plant. You can place it among other plants, and it works several different ways. It's attractive in and of itself, but it's like, you know, matting in a frame. And it draws out the colors of other plants, and it really kind of helps those other plants show off their own beauty. That's one thing that really kind of stands out for me.
Well, and
again,
that,
I'm drawn to grasses, and some of the unusual ones are just kind of breathtaking.
And this one seems to be a little bit more robust, longer straps than ones
seems
from the past.
Seems to be a little bit sturdier. What we're told is that it doesn't flop quite as much. And that's one thing that a lot of the growers are working on. They listen very, very carefully to the public.
One tree that blew me away was the new Acer palmatum Mazazuki, the rose red leaves
gorgeous?
And dark veins. Incredible looking picture of this thing.
It's stunning.
Yeah.
It almost looks like a puzzle on each very, very slender, slender leaf.
Right.
I have not seen the entire plant. Now, granted, I've seen only the leaves.
You've seen the leaf,
but I can imagine that effect would just be a traffic stopper.
It's amazing.
There's another one that I've listed. It is a tree, but I've kind of moved it into the shrubs. It's called Kauai.
Yeah, I saw
it's
that.
It's a full moon maple, and it's a dwarf.
Yeah.
So it's got beautiful foliage, but it's only going to get to be about reliably 2 to 3 and maybe 4 feet. So that would be a beautiful addition to a perennial garden. It's going to be a standout, but it's not going to dominate.
Yeah.
So it's not like it, you know, it's not going to look like it's misplaced. It's going to be a beautiful complement to all the perennials.
Well, Sally, thank you. I wish we had time for all 182, but but we don't. But we'll send readers to your website, and they can look at them at their leisure.
Great.
And they can bug their nurseryman. Maybe we can get these things out in the trade.
And they're all too tempting.
Yes, indeed. Thank you so much, Sally.
Thank you so much yourself.
Sally Benson is the editorial director of American Nurseryman Magazine. For information on the magazine or the plants for 2010, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, Matt Zinder is designing gardens from Finchville, Kentucky to Beijing, China. He joins us in the studio after this break. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
With Bob Hill.
And the international component of the show is about to begin.
I guess.
We're cool by association, I guess, today because we get to speak with Matt Zinder. Matt actually is based in Finchville, Kentucky, not too far from where we live, Andy and I. But his company, Willowbank Gardens, they ecologically design and install landscapes, usually in the area that includes Louisville to Lexington, right?
Mm-hmm.
But not anymore.
Right.
Matt has embarked on a real adventure that takes him to China about once a month, where he's working on several projects with the firm HZS. And he is here in the studio to tell us about working in China and Tibet over the last year or so. Matt, welcome to Homegrown. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
Okay. Bottom line, how on earth did you get this fabulous gig, traveling to China and working on really large scale design jobs?
Well, it is a fabulous gig.
Yeah.
And I, in association with a classmate of mine from the University of Kentucky from years ago, and also through graduate school at the University of Pennsylvania, we collaborated together. He moved away, and I stayed in the United States, of course, moving back to Kentucky. He traveled to Hawaii and started working in Asia from Honolulu, and continued his career for several years in the Hong Kong area, Manila in the Philippines. And then Scott moved back to Atlanta, where he got a little stir crazy and started his own firm in Shanghai. And he commutes as well to Shanghai every month.
What was it that appealed to him about Shanghai? And I guess what is it about you and perhaps your experience or your design expertise or your sensibilities that made you a good fit with a project that is based in Asia and China specifically?
Well, I think the appeal is here when you're working in the U.S., you're working on a lot of constraining budgets. Plant materials are not looked at in the same regard in the United States, I believe, my experience has shown, as they are in Asia. In Asia, when a project begins, the developer gathers all the consultants, all the engineers, all the architects in a room together with all the workers, and the landscape architects then put on a presentation to show them what plant materials they will be using on the job, how they will be installed, and what sizes they're going to use, which are usually from gigantic to enormous in size.
Well, sky's the limit, it sounds
well,
like.
Well, Matt, a lot of your work has the label ecologically designed, which is a good thing, of course. But then you think of China and the enormous growth and the pollution problems. How does that fit over there with what you're doing. Are they more interested in ecology and design than we think they are? Or
yes, they are. The Chinese, I think when many people think of China, and they just think of China, they think of the little red clay tiled roof homes and little Chinese people eating noodles. But I've been dwarfed by many Chinese men on the job site. Oh, they're not all short, as some people think, but their ecological basis is very keen when you're there. They're very aware of the water pollution, the smoky air at times. But many of my days in Beijing and Shanghai and throughout the country in Dalian and Qingdao, clear, beautiful blue skies, good air. I've never worn a mask. I've seen people wearing masks, but the Chinese people are very aware of the environment and their desire to make it better, even for their own selves.
Do you think that some of that is why some of the job, and we'll get into explaining some of the work that you're doing more specifically, but I mean, is that, are people just looking for instant gratification because it's beautiful, or do that, or is there a conscious sort of connection to, okay, if we, you know, really green up this space, it is going to help offset some of the pollution that is here? Or is it really just for aesthetics?
I think mostly it's for aesthetics.
Okay.
There is a huge nursery industry in the country. It is all hand-oriented. There's very little machine orientation, even in the planting and the harvesting of the plant materials. Within the cities, you'll see a tremendous amount of plant material. I think if you paid any attention during the Olympic coverage, you noticed a lot of new, fresh plantings. The Olympics was certainly an eye-opener for many people of what China looks like today.
Mm-hmm.
And the nursery industry is just in its infantile stages there. People are starting to realize the value of a plant and what it can do for the environment. But I would probably have to agree that for the most part, it is aesthetic-based.
Mm-hmm.
When you see it.
So why do you think the infrastructure for a good, solid nursery industry over there is still lagging?
I've been very surprised where nursery materials come from. We'll be driving along what would be considered like I-64 from Louisville to Frankfurt,
mm-hmm.
and you'll see rows and rows of poplars and river birch and different plant material, and these, in effect, are nurseries. And if you see something you like, then the owner or the developer will negotiate with the government who owns these plant materials.
Okay.
So it's good to know someone in the government system. There are private nurseries, and the private nurseries look more like what you would expect to find here in the United States. Big spaces between the plant materials, mm-hmm. to give them room to grow. The government nurseries are more consolidated.
Mm-hmm.
Plant material is very tight.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Matt, can you give us a sense? You mentioned massive jobs. How many plantings, how many plants and trees will go into some of these jobs you're working over? How many acres?
Well, for instance, in Lhasa, Tibet, we're working on a new St. Regis hotel in what would be considered like a New York-style city block. That size will have over 500 trees that are in range of 18 to 24-inch caliper.
Wow.
We'll have boxwood. We'll have sabinas, a lot of color with annual color in the spring and the fall. So they really, really pack the material in, and that's usually one of the concerns that I have to be on guard with is the thinning down of the plant material so that we don't use too much and that it overgrows one another, and then you have the problem of maintenance in the future.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, because as a plant person, are you sometimes... Well, I know that they want it to be big and bold and beautiful, but the reality is it's not necessarily the best for the long-term viability of the plant. I mean, do they expect that some things are going to have to be replaced, or do they expect a certain level of failure?
No, they don't expect a certain level
okay.
of failure.
Okay. That's your job.
It pretty much is the quote expert unquote coming in from
okay.
the United States. They look at myself and also Scott as the two individuals that will make the decisions in regard to the successes of the plant material. So if, for instance, we planted a residential entry for a development in Beijing, the trees were Fraxinus chinensis, Chinese ash trees. Mm-hmm. They look just like our white ash here in Kentucky. We were moving what we would call 20-meter specimens, which would be around 72 feet tall trees.
Wow.
We moved over 60 of them onto the project site at the main entrance. We planted all of the men planted all the trees. We had 75-ton cranes on the job, and one tree was about 12 inches off, and they looked at me and they said, what do you want to do? And I thought for a moment, oh, we'll just let it go. And they said, well, you're responsible if the tree is not perfect. And I said, bring the crane back. They pulled the tree out of the ground. They moved it 12 inches to the left and set it back down. And that was my first project in Beijing, and those trees all survived, and they're really thriving mm-hmm. right now.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, but they obviously want then, for lack of a better phrase, an American touch on these developments. They want an American expert instead of a Chinese expert. What's the rationale for that?
Well, sales.
Ah.
We are figured prominently in the sales brochures. A typical development, if you could compare it to an American development, where here they put a road in and start building homes and sell the homes. In China, they build a sales center and they build an entrance with fountains. And it's not unheard of to spend $3 to $4 million U.S. dollars just on the entrance of the subdivision.
Wow.
And then the sales center is something totally different. But they'll do that so that they can impress the potential buyers. And as I said, our photographs and our bios are in the sales brochures, and also the architects and the interior designers, which almost always come from the United States.
But I think like part of that in and of itself is an appeal to the consumer, because the Chinese consumer now wants, Matt was showing us some outlines, some images, some pictures, some plans of these various things, and they look like brick homes that you might find somewhere in Philadelphia. So clearly there's an architectural style that's starting to change, as well as a planting style. And then to boot, you've got builders and landscape architects that are from America as well.
Oh, yeah. China is pushing into a new realm. I knew that I was almost home when I was in Qingdao, China, which is on the coast where the Olympic sailing events took place. We were at a spa development, pulled up to this spa development, and the first thing that struck me was, did somebody knock me out and drop me in Southern California because of the stucco and the barrel tile roofs?
Huh.
And then walking on the job site with all the Chinese workmen everywhere, I heard Waylon Jennings on a radio playing across the job site. So everything American is very welcome.
But is there, for you, is there a sense of, contemplating the loss of Chinese culture, and one more thing that America actually puts its stamp on or influences, is kind of, in my mind, a little depressing.
It is a little bit. In Beijing, they have the traditional subdivisions, I would call them, but they're called mm-hmm. hutongs
okay.
around the Forbidden City and throughout Beijing. Many of those have been demolished, unfortunately. The developers make their deals. They come in. They move people out to new homes. They don't just put them out in the cold, but they do move them to new places to mm-hmm. live. And they come in and they demolish these beautiful, what we would term as beautiful old architectural gems.
Mm-hmm.
And they come in with high rises, glass and steel, a lot of landscaping. It is somewhat of a shock to me to see some of the things that they demolish. They look perfectly livable.
Mm-hmm.
But I have to keep telling myself, I'm going to try to help them improve what they're going to do to the landscape in the future. I can't control that. But in a like mind, I believe they are realizing and they are beginning to preserve some of the architectural treasures that they have that most people would just say, well, they're very small and insignificant, but they make up the fabric of their society.
And then it seems to me a saving grace to all that is you don't use many American trees. They're hard to find over there. Most of the stuff you plant are native to Asia and China.
Yes, they are.
In an American fashion, sort of. So talk about that a little bit.
Well, a lot of the plant materials that I see, you do have the Cirsus canadensis, you have the red buds, you have the dogwoods. You do have some one oak species that I've been able to locate that is used all over China, the Mongolian oak, the Quercus mongoliaceae. You have A lot of the Salix varieties are there, mm-hmm. From Tibet to Beijing to up north in Harbin. You have a lot of the different Salix varieties.
You had showed us a picture of a Sabina, which I had never seen before, yeah. but was similar to a...
It's similar to a red cedar.
A cedar here.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
But cool. again, the Chinese people will associate certain places with certain plant materials. So it's a little frustrating for me because, you know, here you go to Cave Hill Cemetery. It's a beautiful place in the spring to go and look at the flowers blooming in the trees, leafing out. There in China, when we use, I try to use the Sabina, that's associated with cemetery plantings.
Oh.
So they don't want to do that. They don't want to do that because right. that is for the dead, not for the living.
So you've had to learn, you've had to learn quite a bit beyond just, you know, straight horticultural sorts of things, but that the cultural symbolism of some of these plants. Have you made any major faux pas?
Well, no, I haven't made any major faux pas. Thanks to my interpreter, William Tong, who speaks fluent English. William looks out for me very much, and so do a lot of the ladies in the office over in Shanghai.
Uh-huh.
I travel exclusively with interpreters, and that are also landscape architects, and they know their plant materials. So I haven't made any big faux pas. Some little ones, but it's hard to overcome the limit of plant materials when you want to use, they ask you to screen something, all they have available is the Sabina, but you can't use it because it has to go around the cemetery. So you have to come up, you have to be a little inventive and come up with something new.
Well, kind of walk us through a big project. How you get involved early on and how long does it take and just the whole process?
Well, the projects are, a lot of the projects are years and years in the making, 5 to 10 year projects. When we begin the project, we'll start with a introductory meeting, as I had said before. We'll begin with the sketches. It all happens very fast. The Chinese developer, when they sign the contract, you don't have 3 to 4 months to come up with drawings and to kick off the project. You have literally 2 to 3 weeks at the most. So we have to use the staff to come up with all these drawings and presentation drawings, perspectives, vignettes of little designs, and that it also includes all the sewer profiles and all the spot elevations. Like I said, it happens very quickly, and they want to break ground almost immediately. So once ground is broken, they start putting the roads in, the infrastructure goes in, and at that point, we're out tagging plant material in nurseries as far as, I've been on trips 400 to 500 miles away from a city like Beijing, where they'll bring every tree in on tractor trailers that are just enormous. I mean, I've seen things that I don't think I ever would have seen in the United States.
So how long would it take then for you to go out and find, because you had said to a certain degree, your choices are small. How long does it take for you to go out and find everything that you need to adequately fill these spaces?
Well, sometimes it takes
like
a year or two. Well,
yeah.
Actually, sometimes it takes a very short period of time because we depend on the landscape installer, the landscape company, to find the plant material, and they will come to us and say, "We have found these plants. Come and look at them.
Okay.
If you like them, we will dig them. If you don't like them, we have some more for you to look at."
Okay. Yeah. Because as you had explained too, many of the nurseries, they're not, plants aren't lined out in pots. It's pretty much dig as you commit.
Right. Yeah, it is.
Right. Yes, I want that. Okay, I'll dig it. Yes, I want that. Okay, I'll dig
it. Yes, we've actually tagged plant material in residential yards, large trees.
Really?
I mean, big, unbelievable plant material. It would take 3 people to get around the trunk of a tree.
Uh-huh.
And if the developer wants it, then the developer gets it. So they'll pay the homeowner.
Wow.
We've been in Chengdu, China, where the earthquake was a year and a half or so ago. There's some of the most beautiful nurseries I've ever seen are in Chengdu, China, with just sensationally large trees that have been dug and dug and dug over the years, and they move them and they bring them back and they take them out, and the trees are just beautiful. I mean, they're huge. I can't hardly describe it.
And these are dug by hand, you're talking about, so I imagine the installation process, there must be 50, 100 people there planting trees at the same time.
Exactly.
With shovels.
Yeah. I have been on project sites where one project in particular that I remember because of the ginkgo, which is my favorite tree, and you find it all over China. They planted 70 ginkgos in a period of about 6 hours, and these were 8 to 10 inch caliper ginkgos. Yeah. They craned them all into the site. There were 65 workers on the site, and they had the crews very organized. They had all the holes pre-dug by hand, beautifully dug
like an
holes.
Assembly line, probably. Oh. Everybody had a job.
Oh, it's gorgeous. Yeah. Well, I have to say this quote that I've heard so many times in China when I ask, where is the equipment? Usually the man in charge on the job will look at me and say, China has many people. We don't need equipment.
And I think you said they're earlier paid like $7 or $8 a day for a 12-hour day in America.
A nursery worker will earn about $7 to $8 a day for a 12 to 14-hour day on the job.
Plus shovel.
Yeah, plus shovel. Yeah, and that's all they have. They'll have a shovel, and they'll have some pruning shears and a saw, and that's it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, and you'd said, too, okay, there's some state-owned, government-owned nurseries for trees, that sort of thing, but some privately-owned nurseries as well. Do you see a chance for that sort of thing growing?
I think it could.
Is it time?
I think it is time. I would love to make a deal with someone and start planting materials there. In fact, we have a proposal on the table with one of the largest development companies in China right now to begin a nursery landscape operation on the east coast of China, where we would bring all of the known technology that we have to this company. We would establish a nursery. We would actually bring over our big, the type of American spade trucks that we have here. You see, I've seen one of those in Mongolia, but I've never seen one in mainland China. I've heard that they have some, but I have yet to see one or see a tree produced from one, but we have a proposal right now in the works that if everything goes through and we believe that it will go through, that we will be able to begin this process.
Has it been politics or national pride prevented this from happening?
I think probably it's need. And now that the developments are the developments over there, where when you drive around the Louisville area, you don't really see a lot of spades turning dirt right now. Even in the winter in China, I mean, it is phenomenal the amount of development that is going on right now. It's really kind of scary.
Right. Yeah, I read about that.
Yeah.
So you're traveling around in China, and you said that you've had a project in Lhasa, Tibet. Have you had any difficulties, or is it, pretty easy for you to do your business and not be bothered too much by bureaucrats or governments or whatever?
Not a problem. Okay. Never a problem. I've been welcomed open-armed. I half expected to. I had reservations. I had thoughts of what I thought it would be, but those were unfounded. People have welcomed us. I've had tea in people's homes that just asked us to come and sit down and have tea with them on the close to the job sites. The developers are very open and receptive to our ideas, and the workers like to talk with us. A lot of them do speak English, and that's one of the things you'll hear if you go to Beijing or Shanghai. In a very clipped tone, you'll hear hello, hello, hello. Everybody wants to talk to you.
Yeah.
Do you see this in the lower income or medium income families and homes, the same kind of growth in plants, or has that always been there?
I think it's always been there. What I see right now is a real separation between the upper income, the middle income, and the lower income. You're having some real separation right now that's occurring, and it's it's printed up in the papers a little bit. They're quite aware of
that.
It.
Yeah.
So who's managing Willow Bank back home while you're traveling in China so much?
Oh boy,
you got good people.
Yeah. I have good people at Willow Bank. I've got my brother; he's there, and all of our employees are there, moving the plant materials and installing the gardens, and also my wife Ellen helps out quite a bit. I know that I could not do what I'm doing today without her help.
I doubt you could. Thank you so much, Matt. Thanks for coming in.
Fascinating stuff.
Thank you all.
Sure. Matt Zinder and his Willowbank Garden Company install ecologically sound landscapes in Kentucky. Matt is now working for the firm HZS in China. His wife, Ellen, runs their daylily operation, Finchville Daylilies, from their home and garden in Finchville, Kentucky. For more information on the Zinders and their work, please see our website at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, a few listener questions and Miss Wishy's new Latin Word of the Week. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. This is Bob Hill.
And Janine Wishy.
With a couple of questions.
Yes, indeed.
First from Miss Wishy.
All right.
I have several old-fashioned concrete porch planters. I'd like to know what I can plant in them that would be green throughout the winter. Thanks, Brenda.
Green throughout the winter. Any sort of evergreen little woody plant, little shrub. Gosh, you know, from boxwood to taxus to cane cypress to, you know, anything. The key, really, I think, Bob, is making sure that they're insulated well enough so the roots don't freeze if we have a really, really, really frigid winter, which we typically don't, so mostly they're going to be okay. And then making sure that you keep them well-watered in the summertime. These woody plants, once they dry out significantly, they can't always recover. And, you know, that's when they get lost more than anything else. My recommendation, too, is usually to take, what, 2 or 3 years maximum in terms of keeping plants like this in those containers. Then you can cycle them out, plant them in the yard, and get, you know, get a new evergreen.
Or I can plant, I like yews, and sometimes I just cut yews back, Y-E-W-S.
Taxus,
Yeah, taxus, and cut them back, because they'll stay nice deep green most of the winter, and then you can kind of prune them like a bonsai, too, and prune the top and the bottom and put them back in there, but either way is fine.
Sure.
But they're not going to last forever in those pots. You have to do something at some point.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
All right. Another question. This one's from John. He has a tomato hybrid question. He says, let's say I plant seed from a hybrid. I don't get the exact plant tomatoes, the hybrid, but I like the result. So this is the second year, right? He saves the seed from that one. Would that one come back true to its parent? If not, how many times would I have to go through the process in order to consistently get the same tomato from the seed I planted?
Yeah, I'm not sure if he wants the original hybrid, which was not going to happen, or the second-year plant, which will happen in a couple of years, I think, if he keeps planting that same seed. He'll never get his original hybrid back.
Yeah, I think he wants to know how many times would the process have to go through in order to consistently get the same tomato. And if from a hybrid, I would say 3 years. Your third year should be that consistency mark, because most hybrids are either F1 or F2s. So by that third year, all of that fancy parentage should have been bred away.
Gone.
And they would have reverted back
You're
to
out of here.
And then it should be consistent.
Okay.
Yeah. Doesn't that make sense if it's an F1 or F2?
I'm going to let John do that.
Yeah. So 3 years, you should get consistency.
If it doesn't, give us a call.
That's right.
If you have a question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org. Email us at homegrown@WFPL.org. Or call us at 502-814-8246. Well, as usual, Miss Wishy, your Latin word of the week comes right to the point.
Right to the point. Tapers into a point. Acuminata, acuminatus, or acuminatum.
I didn't know that. I should have known this.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Huh.
For some reason.
Yeah, acuminata. Clethra acuminata.
The mountain sweet pepper bush.
Very pointy kind of slender foliage.
I get the message on
That's
that
right.
one, yeah.
Musa acuminata.
The edible banana.
Edible banana.
Did they come to a point?
Mm-hmm. Nicotiana
acuminata. Yeah. The many flower tobacco.
Think about what Nicotiana looks like.
The points.
Yeah.
Good
Potentilla
point.
Acuminata.
sounds like an animal. The taper tip cinquefoil.
Cinquefoil.
Cinquefoil. Taper tip cinquefoil.
Penstemon acuminatus.
Oh, the old sharp leaf penstemon.
Aster acuminatus.
Oh, yeah. The world wood aster.
Wood aster. So, yeah, if it's acuminate, right, usually means that it comes to a point.
It does now.
It does, yes. And typically, if you see that, it's going to refer to the actual leaf of the plant, not really anything else. But I suppose we can't say that outright, right?
No.
But acuminata, acuminatus, or acuminatum means tapers into a point.
I get the message.
All right. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown. We hope that you'll join us again next week for another show.
Homegrown is produced by the finely tipped Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.